This is the podcast, Surgery ICU Rounds. My name is Dr. Jeffrey Guy. I'm an associate professor of surgery and director of the Burn Center at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. The topic that we're going to discuss today is that of hypothermia. There was a rather spectacular emergency landing or plane crash, depending on how you look at it, recently here in the United States, where a U.S. Airlines jet on a very cold day in Manhattan landed on the Hudson River. And all the occupants of the plane were basically unhurt and were able to evacuate into the river on the wings. And this certainly brought up the idea of what is environmental hypothermia. We talk a lot about hypothermia now in regards to its therapy, and we've recently had a discussion and a podcast on the use of hypothermia for the post-cardiac arrest patient, and there's also a growing body of literature about the use of hypothermia in patients who have not only brain injuries, but CNS lesions, how that's applied in the neurointensive care unit. But the topic I want to talk today is, what is the treatment and the problems associated with environmental hypothermia? Somebody who may come in as a cold water drowning or a trauma patient, or a homeless person who's perhaps found in a snowbank. And having done my training in the northern part of the United States and have treated many patients who've come in with profound hypothermia after being passed out or found in a snowbank or being a victim of a motor vehicle crash with a prolonged extrication or delayed in being fined. So accidental hypothermia, what is the actual definition of it? And hypothermia is really, by definition, as an unintentional decline in the core body temperature below 35 degrees centigrade or 95 degrees Fahrenheit. And there are some conditions that are associated with hypothermia, and basically those can be broken down into two big groups. Those conditions where the patient has an intact thermoregulation, and those conditions where the patient for some reason has impaired thermoregulation. So let's look first at those patients who have intact thermoregulations, and that would be environmental accidental exposure to basically cold or extreme temperatures, and that would be cold water immersions, outdoor activities with physical exhaustion, and patients who may have inadequate indoor heating because they're homeless or they're impoverished. They may live outdoors or they may live in an abandoned building and not obviously have adequate heating. Other conditions that will have intact thermoregulation but be associated with an increased risk of the development of hypothermia are different endocrinopathies and metabolic disorders, and these include hypothermia, patients who have hypoadrenalism, panhypopituitarism, patients with anorexia nervosa or protein malnutrition, as well as hypoglycemia, and those patients who have diabetes mellitus with a neuropathy. Now, the patients that I take care of have intact thermoregulation, but have the potential for developing rather profound hypothermia, and those are patients with burns. Other patients who've had dysregulation or loss of their dermal integrity, erythroderma patients with psoriasis. Now, let's change gears a little bit and look at the patients who have impaired thermoregulation, and this would include patients who are on certain medications or they're on drugs or intoxications, certainly patients who have intoxicated with ethanol, patients on phenothiazines, tricyclic antidepressants, barbiturates, neuromuscular blocking agents, and this is certainly relevant and important in the intensive care unit, patients with clonidine, toxic doses of lithium, will also result in some hypothermia, and certainly anesthesia, anticholinergics, and patients who've suffered from carbon monoxide poisoning are at predisposition for hypothermia. There are patients with chronic debilitating conditions that predispose them, patients with just outright old, patients with heart failure, renal failure, alcoholism, head trauma, patients with CNS lesions such as strokes or tumors, paraplegic patients, certainly patients with Parkinson's disease, those with multiple sclerosis, and then there's always our patients who have sepsis. So that is a breakdown. It's a rather long laundry list of those patients who you should certainly be thinking of the patient being at predisposition for the development of an environmental hypothermia. how you go about approaching a patient with hypothermia is going to depend really on the classification. Is it mild, moderate, or severe? And really, mild hypothermia is those patients who have, say, a body temperature between 32 and 35 degrees centigrade. And these patients will typically manifest themselves by having increased tone. They'll be shivering. They may have an increase in their heart rate, rapid breathing. And they have something called a cold diuresis. And this is going to be important because we need to explain what a cold diuresis is and how it really impacts our management or the actual resuscitation of the patient who is retreating for hypothermia. Patients will also have a bradycardia and a decrease in their minute volume, which means they can also, in addition to having, as we said, rapid heart rate and rapid breathing, as we get progressive, we'll see that heart rate start slowing down to the point where we're bradycardic. And again, this cold diuresis will actually can cause a hypovolemia or dehydration. Generally, the approach to these patients is external rewarming, things just as a blanket and a warm environment, and usually only rewarming techniques are necessary. We don't typically need to be more invasive than that. And usually these patients will recover well, if there's no systemic complications from the hypothermia. Now, active external rewarming rather than passive rewarming should be used in patients when passive rewarming is not successful. So you're putting this patient on a warm blanket, or we use these bear huggers. Patients who have poikilothermia, basically a core temperature less than 32 degrees centigrade. So obviously now we're not talking about this mild hypothermia. We're talking about a condition that's much more severe. Or when the patient has cardiovascular instability, are they having hypotension from the cold diuresis or volume issues, or are they having some poor cardiac performance from the bradycardia associated with hypothermia? Now, moderate hypothermia we are defining as a temperature between 28 and 32 degrees centigrade. For those of you who are stuck on Fahrenheit system, that's between 82 and 90 degrees Fahrenheit. These patients will have a progressive slowing down of the body functions. Typically, you won't see any shivering. The patients will be rigid. Their mental status will be obtunded or comatose, and they could be hypotensive, and they could have that lowering of the minute ventilation where they're actually hypoventilating. Basically, you need to start with your ABCs. Always go back to your ABCs and address your basic life support type of interventions, and advanced life support is required. Because the patient, because of their decrease in mental status, there may be a decrease in upper airway tone and the ability for them to protect their airway, and therefore you may need to intubate the patient just to protect their airway. And you'll also use that later on, which we'll talk about as a method of potentially rewarming the patient. This will allow you to assure that the airway is protected. You can then ventilate them out of their hypoventilation by assuring they have an adequate minute ventilation. If you don't know what minute ventilation is, that's basically your tidal volume times your rate. And that gives you your liters per minute ventilation. You also need to be worried about the patient gastric contents because of their altered mental status. They're at higher risk for development of an aspiration. The other thing that the endotracheal tube certainly does is allow you to provide warm humidified gases. And this is a very effective way of rewarming patients. And typically when patients will get cold in the operating room, this is one thing you need to really be mindful of, because what we do is we turn the operating room up to, 85, 90 degrees. We may use French fry lights that we like to call them, and maybe even bear huggers. We've talked before about how we can cool patients down. Well, you transfer heat through ways of what's called conduction, convection, and radiation. And conduction, much like electricity, is that if I'm putting my hand on something that's cold, I'll lose heat by trying to conduct my temperature into that colder item. Those of you who go camping, you may have what's like a thermarest mattress. This is a small, thin air mattress, basically, that's probably about an inch thick, and it's not really designed so much for comfort, so you're not sleeping on the hard ground, but it's so you don't sleep on the cold ground. Because when you're sleeping on the cold ground, you're actually trying to warm the ground up. You're trying to transfer that heat. And by having that thermarest air mattress there, it's acting as basically a thermal barrier. And so you're not losing as much heat. This is why it's important that if you're taking care of somebody in a pre-hospital setting and they're hypothermic, that you really want to get them off the ground. not because of, you know, our insensitivities of having a patient lay on the ground, but as long as they're on that cold, hard ground, they're going to continue to try to transfer heat. This is the idea of conduction. Now, convection, we've all heard about convective ovens, movement of air, and that's one way that you can transfer heat. We talked about cooling patients, and this way we're talking about warming patients. And this is how somebody is in a hot room on a night and they have a fan blowing over the body. When I was a kid, we didn't have air conditioning, and you know, we would have a fan in our room. Well, does the fan actually lower the temperature in the room? Well, how does it? There's no way to explain that. But what the fan does is by creating a current of air over the body, you're actually transferring heat through convection. Now, radiation, you know what radiation is that if I have I go outside, I'm trying to radiate my heat out, and I'm trying to heat the room by radiation. This is one of the ways that the French fry lights work, or elevating the temperature in the room. So you're basically decreasing the gradient of temperature, basically the transference of heat. If I make the room temperature as close to body temperature, there's not going to be a difference in heat. This is how people can get heat stroke when it's hot out. We've done podcasts on this. I'm not sure on IC rounds, but I know we certainly have on the PHTLS podcast. If you've ever worked in a hot room with some of these plastic gowns that we're using now when we're taking care of patients and an idea to prevent infectious disease, the nurses are wearing basically these plastic gowns and the doctors that are kind of like garbage bags made of similar type materials. Well, when you have that on, you get really hot because you can't radiate that heat off. So conduction, convection, and radiation. One of the things that by using a heated ventilator circuit, an average adult male basically has a total body surface area of about 1.8 to 2 square meters. So when you're trying to heat the body through 1.8 to 2 square meters, you're very limited with a finite area, but the surface area of the lung is dozens of square meters. And when you're using humidified gases, you're able to transfer that heat over a much larger surface area than when you're trying to apply or use the techniques of conduction and convection radiation to just the body, because you're dealing with just, again, that 1.8 to 2 square meters. So now I want to talk about this issue of this cold diuresis, or the intravascular volume depletion. And this is reasonably common in hypovolemic or in cold patients. And what happens is that during the cold diuresis, you get the kidney has a decreased ability to basically concentrate the urine, and there's a plasma shift to the extravascular space. And this is combined with a decreased secretion of antidiuretic hormones. So all this really kind of creates kind of a perfect storm where you get an inappropriate diuresis, because you get the volume depletion from fluid to the extravascular space. So it's almost like a third spacing of fluid that you might see following a major injury or major operation or a burn. And at the same time, you're getting this increase in urine output because the kidney is not able to concentrate the urine. This, that combined with the ability for the body's not producing as much antidiuretic hormone. So those three things, okay, inability to concentrate the urine, decreased ADH production, and extravascular volume shifts set a patient up for intravascular volume depletion. So you have to really kind of resuscitate this patient. And when you go about resuscitating them, a normal saline is preferred to lactate ringers. This is one of the few times you'll actually hear me say this, but the reason why you want to use saline over lactate ringers is because through the hypothermia, there's a decreased ability of the liver to actually take the lactate and metabolize it to bicarb. So what would happen is if you're giving somebody a lot of lactate ringers, and this happens more commonly than I care to mention, is that people always equate an elevated lactate with poor oxygen delivery. And so what they say is, aha, we need to give them more fluid. And people forget the fact that lactate requires metabolism by the liver. So somebody could have a shock liver, they could have a major liver injury, or in this case, hypothermia. And what it is that you need to actually change your fluid over. There are a variety of ways of warming IV fluids. I think what most most hospitals use now are what's something called a level one fluid warmer. This is kind of a neat device, and the way the level one fluid warmer works, it's kind of a neat trivia question, but it works with something called a countercurrent heat exchange. It's actually very much like the leg of an Arctic wolf. How is it that a wolf can stand on the ice, an Arctic wolf, and not get hypothermic when all the blood's going to the foot, getting cooled and coming back? Is that it works basically through a countercurrent exchange system, very much like the kidney. So if you take this wolf's leg, for instance, you have an artery that's running down the leg, you've got a vein that's returning up, and the vein that's returning up is carrying blood that was down onto the ice, and it's very cold. But as the artery and vein are running side by side, heat is transferred from the warm arterial blood to the cold venous blood, and basically try to preserve the heat. When you look at a level one infuser, there's a cylinder there, and warm water is flowing in one direction, and cold, and the cold IV fluid's flowing in the other, and basically you're warming the fluid in that direction. There's all kinds of ways that people do it. There's microwave ovens can be used to heat fluids up, and I'm sure there's some sort of Joint Commission violations about that, and there's some concerns as well as that you're getting hot spots in the fluid. One of the things you really want to avoid is early potassium replacement, and this is really because the safe clinical predictors of changes in electrolyte values during rewarming, you just really aren't very sure. Hypothermia may mask some EKG changes induced by potassium levels, and the other thing is that the immobile hypothermic patient is really predisposed to development of rhabdomyolysis, and we've talked about what rhabdomyolysis is that if you have a patient who's hypothermic, they've been in the cold, they're more likely to break down the muscle, more likely to release pigment in their urine, which is poisonous to the urine. But remember, if muscle breaks down, it's releasing myoglobin. It's also likely to be releasing potassium as well, and that that myoglobin certainly predisposes us to development of acute tubular necrosis. Now, let's focus a little bit on the heart. And the if you'd imagine that the heart of the hypothermic patient is really very stiff and poorly compliant. And so this means that you require higher filling pressure to maintain the same preload. So what is compliance? Well, this is going to get into some physics, but change in pressure over change in volume is a definition of compliance. It's a derivative, if you want to get your money from your calculus. And compliance curves are not linear. They're typically an exponential type curve. So if somebody has, and this is one of the things we say, that saying that all my patients in my ICU should have a wedge of 18. What's really idiotic about that statement is that what we want to measure is the end diastolic volume, not the pressure. We talked about this in a previous podcast. Well, that relationship between pressure and volume is compliance, and everybody's heart is different based on their compliance. A young, healthy person, I don't know why they would have a Swan, but a young, healthy person with a Swan-Ganz catheter may get the same preload from a volume standpoint with a much lower wedge pressure than the person who has a sick heart that is non-compliant from previous MIs and scar, because you need to use more pressure to extend that ventricle. Well, the heart of a hypothermic patient is non-compliant. It is stiff. Therefore, you need that higher filling pressures. The other issue that you have with a heart in a hypothermic patient are cardiac arrhythmias, and they are relatively common. Risks increase as the temperature drop about below 30 degrees centigrade. They usually will progress. We said that initially the patients will be tachycardic, and then they'll kind of progress down to a sinus bradycardia, and then to atrial fibrillation, and then kind of a subsequent slowing of the ventricular response until you're down into ventricular fibrillation and ultimately a systole. Now, on the issue of cardiac arrhythmias, this comes down to one of the things that's really important, that when we're transferring these patients, and sometimes we forget as patients are getting transferred from helicopters or ambulances to emergency room cots and eventually to the ICU, I think sometimes we're rather insensitive, and sometimes we move patients like they're, you know, nothing short of a bag of potatoes. This is very potentially harmful in a hypothermic patient, and because of all of the sympathetic tone and vasoactive drugs and the hypothermia, these patients can actually break down into a ventricular fibrillation by just rough handling them. So it's really important that we'll talk that when we move a cold patient, that we approach them much like you're handling a porcelain doll. And this same myocardial irritability also needs to be extrapolated into the risks of placing intravenous catheters, or even considering, you know, something like a PA catheter. Really, you need to be mindful that you're dealing with a patient who has a very irritable heart, and that by if you're advancing the wire too far into the heart, or by floating a PA catheter or a Swan, that you really can precipitate a malignant arrhythmia. So the other issue is that the patient who has a hypothermia, and you say you're putting a line in or floating a Swan in, that unless they're rewarmed, the V fib is very difficult, if not refractory, to therapy. So you can be floating a Swan, so I'll give them lidocaine or give them amiodarone. That may not actually work. Usually you can't really get to a good perfusing rhythm in that case until the core body temperature rises to about 30 degrees centigrade. If defibrillation attempts with up to 3 shocks are unsuccessful and the patient's temperature is still about 30 degrees, you need to continue to try to escalate your resuscitative efforts. What used to be said, Louis Goldfrank, who is an emergency physician of great notoriety, who was at Bellevue Medical Center in New York, and as a toxicologist, he had kind of expression. I remember reading an article that he wrote, or it was one of the books that he wrote, was basically that a patient's not dead until they're warm and dead. And this is kind of what you need to be thinking of, is that you'll have a patient and they're in a cardiac arrhythmia and they're hypothermic. You need to really get that patient warmed up, because all of the efforts that we typically do in regards to pharmacotherapy or defibrillation are likely to be not successful in the presence of hypothermia. Now talking a little bit about some of the active rewarming techniques. And again, the active external rewarming are basically taking something that's hot and putting it next to the bot. And they are typically effective in raising the body temperature. And we're not talking about some of this. There's certainly more newer commercial devices that are employed. But some of the more common things that include use of hot water bottles, radiant heat that we talked about, such as the French fry lights, I like to call them, forced line air warming systems, heating blankets, even immersion, which is like putting a patient in a tub of water at between 32 and 41 degrees centigrade. These techniques do have potential risks and potential complications. By rapidly external warming a patient, that you can cause vasodilation. And what we said to be mindful is that we're talking about vasodilation in a patient who's already potentially hypovolemic from their cold diuresis. And when they vasodilate, what happens is that you get a return of cold acidotic blood to the core, and this is often referred to as an afterdrop. So you get this acidotic cold blood. This may actually basically shock the heart and cause more cardiac arrhythmias, or even just an overt cardiac arrest. So this is another thing you need to be putting into your calculus when you're moving these patients. If they've got a limb that you don't want to be raising their limb rapidly, because again, that cold acidotic blood will be rushed into the central circulation and cause these cardiovascular problems. As we talked about, hypotension and a hypovolemia may occur from peripheral vasodilation and venous pooling. And again, therefore, it's essential that volume repletion with warmed IV fluids is not overlooked during this rewarming process. And I've actually seen this mentioned in critical care board review courses. Now, because of the potential circulatory problems associated with active external rewarming, combined modalities of external heat to the trunk as well as active core rewarming may be beneficial and actually may reduce some of these potential complications. As a general rule, if your patient is hemodynamically stable and has a perfusible rhythm and appears to be cardiovascular in a safe spot, and they have a core temperature, say, between 29 and 32 degrees centigrade, they should be considered for active external rewarming. In addition, some internal rewarming can be done by some various means. Typically, the most common is the use of warm IV fluids. I would put a little asterisk of caution in this, is that, you know, there are different types of warmers available. You know, do not just put a patient on a level 1 and actively resuscitate without any respect to the amount of IV fluid you're giving just because you're using a level 1 fluid warmer. There are fluid warmers that you can attach to pumps, and as you were resuscitating this patient with normal saline for the reasons we've mentioned above, re-expanding their intravascular volume, but you don't need to do that blindly by just giving them a liter at a time. Other methods of internal active rewarming, we've already mentioned, and that's the use of humidified warm gases, and this can raise somebody's body temperature on average about 1 to 2 degrees centigrade per hour, and it's really essential. Now, if the patient is hemodynamically unstable or they don't have an adequately perfusing rhythm, you need to be actually a little bit more aggressive. This can use things like peritoneal lavage using heated crystalloids. We'd say that in the old days, peritoneal lavage was used pretty commonly, not used so much anymore because of the availability of rapid access to CAT scanners in emergency departments or fast use of ultrasound scanners looking for intra-abdominal fluid. But in the old days, we used to use peritoneal lavage with some regularity, but you can certainly use warm IV fluids in peritoneal lavage. Close pleural irrigation through large bore chest tubes. Certainly more of a limited role. You can use bladder irrigations with Keyes irrigations, as well as using warm fluids down NG tubes and colonic irrigation. All of those have some moderate success, but probably the granddaddy of them all is cardiopulmonary bypass. Extracorporeal rewarming, again, is like we said, this is the grand method, the daddy of them all of effective rapid rewarming. This is through the use of basically a cardiopulmonary bypass circuit. And the core can be rewarmed directly, again, by using these circuits. Full cardiopulmonary bypass using meter sternotomy has been used in many centers. But when available, you can basically put somebody on bypass by using fem-fem bypass as well. It should be used when it's available in all patients who have hypothermia, say less than 28 degrees centigrade, and lack a perfusing rhythm. Now, during severe hypothermia, patients usually appear to be dead. Patients may have dilated fixed pupils with lack of corneal or brainstem reflexes. They are pulseless. They can be apneic. Because of the decreased oxygen requirements of cold organs, though, even patients who suffer prolonged cardiac arrest may recover without serious long-term sequela. And again, this is the exception, not the rule. This is typically seen in children or very young adults. And therefore, a lot of people are of the opinion that people should continue to resuscitate a patient until, again, their core body temperatures return to 32 degrees centigrade and the patient's unresponsive to resuscitative efforts once they're at 32 degrees. And that's kind of the idea. They're not dead until they're warm and dead. Other things you need to be mindful of are some common problems associated with hypothermia. We've already talked about alcoholism and people who are intoxicated commonly are at risk for the development of hypothermia, and therefore you need to be thinking about how you would prophylax these patients for potential metabolic complications, namely delirium tremens. So you should be giving these people IV thiamine pretty typically, and that should always be preceded by administration of glucose, and because what you're trying to prevent there is Wernicke's encephalopathy. And again, you would just want to give somebody, say, 50 to 100 mLs of D50. The use of antibiotics, I don't know why you would do that. We used to do this routinely when we thought about people who had aspiration pneumonitis, but now we like to be treating infections and not be prophylaxing people as much as we used to in days gone by. Now, the use of steroids is something you need to be considered. I'm not a big fan of giving everybody steroids, but again, when you go back and look at some of the causes that we mentioned for the development of patients who are predisposed to development of hypothermia, a lot of them had endocrinopathies. So you need to be mindful of, does your patient have some sort of history of steroid dependency or adrenal insufficiency or myxedema? And if so, you know, do you need to give them, say, 100 milligrams of hydrocortisone? The use of IV thyroid hormone replacement, again, it should be restricted to patients who have a history of hypothyroidism or they've got some sort of clinical evidence that makes you think that they're having myxedema coma, or you look at them and they've got a big old scar across their neck and, you know, indicative of a thyroidectomy. Other things you need to be thinking about, obviously, is after active rewarming, patients are at predisposition to develop pancreatitis. If they're having an ileus, not tolerating a PO diet, or nausea or vomiting in days following a treatment hypothermia, again, pancreatitis is something that you may see in this particular population of patients. So that is a brief review on some of the clinical signs and symptoms, manifestations, and treatment that you would see in an environmental hypothermia. You've been listening to the podcast Surgery ICU Rounds. My name is Jeffrey Guy.